German Chancellor Angela Merkel is on a farewell tour in Washington today. She's meeting with President Biden. One fortunate area of common ground, they both believe in science.
The importance of a science-based approach to common global challenges like pandemics and climate change.
Also today, a fragile ceasefire breaks down in East Africa after rebels in northern Ethiopia invade a neighboring region.
This appears to be something of a red line for the federal government.
I'm Marco Werman, and spare a thought for the poor English eel.
Rich people make laws. Rich people like to fish and eat salmon and trout, and so salmon and trout get really well protected.
No such luck for the slimy eel, until now. And looking to take a cruise to Venice? Hold off a bit. That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Today in Europe, a major move to prioritize LGBTQ rights. The European Commission launched legal proceedings against Hungary and Poland after both countries introduced laws that the EU says discriminate against LGBTQ people. This comes just a week after a Pride event in Georgia was attacked. Dozens of people were injured in the capital, Tbilisi. 37-year-old journalist Alexander Lashkarava was later found dead. He had been covering the event when he was severely beaten by counter-protesters. As The World's Bianca Hillier reports, LGBTQ advocates in Tbilisi are hoping for more European support.
Shota Digmalashvili knew there was the potential for violence at Tbilisi Pride, but he didn't think it would get as bad as it did.
The environment was very hostile, but we did not expect such terrible ignorance. We thought that the police would interfere, of course.
Digmalashvili is a founding member of the Shame Movement, an activist group in Georgia who helped organize Tbilisi Pride. Police stood by, he says, as counter-protesters stormed their offices and ripped down rainbow flags. A week later, Georgian authorities have yet to take action. Still, he says queer activists there know they need to show up.
Visibility is important because without visibility, there is no attention to those rights.
Attention from Georgian politicians and from leaders representing other countries. More than 24 foreign embassies in Georgia signed a joint statement condemning the violence. And yesterday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price sent condolences and a warning from Washington.
We do call for calm and an end to the violence that has already caused one tragic loss of life. We remind Georgia's leaders and its law enforcement of their responsibility to protect all of those, exercising their constitutional rights.
Members of the European Parliament have also been vocal, including Rasmus Andresen from Germany.
It is important for LGBTI to hear and see that they are not alone, that there actually are politicians and other people in public speaking up for their rights.
Andresen says speaking up about Georgia's lack of action can lead to change because authorities there don't want to look bad on the world stage. In Tbilisi, Shota Digmalashvili agrees and says he's grateful for the verbal support.
Yes, it's very significant.
But critics have long faulted politicians for being slow to turn statements into action. It's a fine line to navigate, says Philip Ayoub, an associate professor of diplomacy and world affairs at Occidental College. Placing sanctions on a country's government for human rights abuses, he says, can sometimes further vilify the marginalized group.
Local communities are then punished for sanctions that come at a country. It can further fuel this narrative of LGBTI rights are foreign imposition upon us and that local LGBT people are actually foreign agents themselves or are not part of local communities.
Global leaders are sending out more statements and tweets as LGBTQ rights are more often included in human rights discussions. But parliamentarian Rasmus Andresen says it needs to go further. He believes LGBTQ rights are vital to foreign policy considerations. And following the violence in Tbilisi, he says if Georgia wants to be a European partner, They need to act.
We need to ensure that in international politics, when it comes to diplomacy, we are not just talking about economic collaboration, but that we are also pointing out if we are seeing some problems related to the human rights situation.
Philip Ayoub says there has been increased conversation about LGBTQ rights being a litmus test for partnership. But for most countries, they have yet to become a deal breaker in international relations.
In the grand scheme of things, there's still a long way to go into which LGBTI rights are really, really folded into human rights and get the same kind of attention as other kinds of issues.
Advocates say today's legal proceedings against Hungary and Poland are a good sign. Still, back in Tbilisi, people aren't waiting for that to happen. Thousands, including activists, journalists, and opposition politicians, have returned to the streets, claiming their place in the country and calling for Prime Minister Irakli Garabashvili to resign. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The government in South Africa has had enough. The government is sending out 25,000 soldiers to quell a week of looting and violence. The rush of anger broke out after former President Jacob Zuma was sent to jail for contempt of court. Businesses are paying a heavy toll from the unrest. Mbali Ndlovu is a co-founder of Rebuild SA, a volunteer group helping businesses recover. She joined us from Johannesburg.
I wish there was one word to describe it outside of hectic, which is one of our local words that we use for everything. There has been heartache. There's been just a lot of emotions. I think the tragedy of it all is the people that are getting hurt in the process, which has turned out to be small businesses. And not just businesses, it's families and the families of each of the members that contribute to that business. It's your average South African who's just confused, demotivated. We're all going through a really heavy time at the moment. It's absolutely insane. From children who've lost lives as a result to grown people, to the elderly. And it's just very strange, you know, because we grew up to respect our elders and to have Ubuntu and collectivity and to see ourselves kind of at such deep conflicts is overwhelming.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen at least 117 people have lost their lives in this unrest. How did you and your partners start this volunteering initiative? And what are you doing and what are you hoping to accomplish?
It all started by mistake in the best way possible. Imelda, who I co-found with here, so I run a community for entrepreneurs, people looking for opportunities, small businesses to connect, and that's called I Know a Guy. And usually someone will go, hey, I need this done, and someone knows a guy and they refer one another. And so she made a very unusual request, which is, hey, I'd like to volunteer to help clean up a place that was affected by the violence. And from that moment, so many people have just put a hand forward, you know, whether it's people who can volunteer hands to clean, people that have construction companies, to graphic designers who not only want to design, redesign logos and help companies with the new CI, but they're also willing to put up just marketing materials for the shops and design this and that and pay for the printing. And that was 2 days ago. We've grown to tens of thousands of members. We have thousands of registered volunteers who are just literally waiting on us to instruct them to go where, what, wherever. And that's been the journey so far. So that's been really, really overwhelming.
I mean, you sound really encouraged, really positive about this response, but South Africa's in dire straits right now. What are some of the interactions? Yeah. Maybe you can share some examples of people you're helping to get back on their feet.
Some people have lost literally everything. People have lost their lives, okay? Like a security guard who came to work at a crazy hour and ended up losing his life because he had to provide for his family. There are other people who have just come out and beaten the odds and created a successful business for themselves. And what's been really awesome is to be able to find counseling for these guys. I mean, something is that restores human dignity, like your business being cleaned and walls being painted. Because the way that we see it as well is the cleanup is phase one. And then how do we build the foundations of empowerment and unity again? And that's been where the real work is coming in.
So you've been cleaning the streets with Rebuild SA, but I've seen businesses that look like they're so damaged. It'll take major investment to rebuild. What happens to those businesses?
Well, a lot of those businesses are done for. They're gone, closed shop and out. They've got to figure out a new way to eat in a place of limited opportunity. And now, worsened economy, 78% of our youth classified in South Africa as people 35 down to 18, don't have income. They are unemployed. Our unemployment rate went from 30-something percent to about a 40-something percent. Things are looking really, really bad. But also at the same time, through this Rebuild SA initiative, just today alone, a really, really huge global corporation came and phoned us and said, which businesses have completely lost everything? We want to help them, support them from the ground up, rebuild everything and set them up for a couple of months. We want to do that. And that has really, really moved me. It's overwhelming. It's unreal. It actually feels like it's not happening. Like it's some kind of weird dream. So yeah, a lot has gone bad. A lot is really, really terrible. And I'm not trying to exaggerate anything, but it is bad. But also at the same time, there's hope. There are people who want to help. There are people who want to bring us back to a place of peace.
Mbali Ndlovu is one of the co-founders of Rebuild SA, a volunteer group helping businesses rebuild and recover in the aftermath of the looting in South Africa. Mbali, thank you very much. It's great to meet you.
Thank you for your time.
Germany is dealing with floods that have killed at least 40 people. Chancellor Angela Merkel is calling them a catastrophe. She was in Washington today when she described the situation back home. Merkel's in D.C. making what will almost certainly be her final White House visit as Germany's leader, a tenure that has lasted more than 15 years. There's a lot for Merkel and President Biden to iron out. To talk about some of the wrinkles is Constanze Stelzenmüller with the Brookings Institution. Constanze, I know you listened to Angela Merkel's remarks at Johns Hopkins University, where she received an honorary degree earlier today. What was her message?
Well, I think her message was one that was firmly focused on things that America and Germany can agree on, or to put it slightly more precisely, that the Biden administration and Germany can agree on, which is the importance of a science-based approach to common global challenges like pandemics and climate change. She said that's what we need to work on, and the floods at home have shown how urgent this is.
What about Joe Biden? I mean, what does he get out of this visit?
I think the Biden administration realizes just how central not just Europe, but Germany are to their transatlantic agenda, to their Europe agenda, and even to relations with China. Because so much of what not just China, but also Russia are doing to exert influence over political outcomes, not just in their own neighborhoods, but in Europe, to in fact pressure European nations to align with them, is done with non-military means through disinformation, propaganda, corruption, influence buying, trade, which for Germany is extremely important to make the Germans side with them rather than with the US. So yes, this is very important for Biden to get Angela Merkel and the German government on his side.
So one thorn in the U.S.-German relationship is the Russian Nord Stream pipeline, which will deliver natural gas directly from Russia to Germany, but bypassing Ukraine. Explain the issue here, Constanze, on why this is a problem for the White House.
For now, most Russian gas comes to Europe through the Ukrainian transit pipeline. The Ukrainian government feels very strongly, and some Eastern and Central Eastern European governments agree with it, that this is the key factor preventing Vladimir Putin from putting even more pressure on Ukraine than it is right now with this ongoing proxy war in the eastern provinces of Ukraine. The US and the Biden administration agree with this critique and have been urging Germany for years to stop the pipeline. That's probably no longer an option, and the Biden administration seems to agree with this because it's nearly completed.
So Constanze Merkel, as I said, has been there for 15 years as Germany's chancellor. I mean, that's a long time as head of state. How did this likely final visit to Washington make you feel, just in terms of a marker in the history books?
It's not irrelevant to me that she was Germany's first female chancellor. But as an expert on foreign and security policy, I look at her record with very mixed feelings. I think that she modernized the country. She made Germany more powerful. She made it into the economic and political hub of Europe. But I also think that her style of governance, careful brokering of compromises, and the balancing out in particular of America and the East, whether that's Russia and China, is no longer persuasive at a time when Russia and China are aggressively interfering in our concerns within the West and within Europe and in my own country. And so I think is a very real sense in Germany, and I subscribe to that, that it's time for a new approach. The question is whether her successor will do that.
Constanze Stelzenmüller is the Fritz Stern Chair on Germany and Transatlantic Relations at the Brookings Institution. Constanze, thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, as always.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Time for a fish tale, a decidedly English one, about eels. Yep, not the most attractive of fish. They're kind of like swimming snakes, slithery and slightly creepy. In Britain, eels used to be a really big deal and highly valued. Jellied eel pie with mashed potatoes was a popular dish. In medieval times, you could pay your rent in eels. Not so long ago, eels were everywhere.
People in Somerset now could remember a time when eels were so plentiful that you could pretty much fish them out with buckets.
Reporter Catherine Nixie has been writing about eels for The Economist. The fish were the topic of a recent episode of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio.
Eels are suffering from so many different problems at the moment. Climate change is affecting them, as too are new invasive parasites that they're suffering from. And water turbines are particularly nasty for eels. They spin around and cut adult eels up like sushi, as one of the eel researchers I spoke to put it. But the biggest barrier that eels face in this country is actual barriers, just weirs and dams and all the many, many things that you see if you walk up an English river that get in the way of the water. And therefore in the way of the eel. In Europe as a whole, there are 1.2 million barriers. And if their movement is blocked, then they struggle to reproduce because they can't get to the places they need to spawn and they can't get back.
And it's not a secret, says Catherine. People have known for centuries that English rivers are difficult for eels.
The barons bullied King John into putting eel passes into the Magna Carta. Richard the Lionheart legislated for eel passes. He said you had to have a space between obstructions that was big enough for a three-year-old hog to get through. Thomas Cromwell legislated to have noisome weirs that stop fish breeding taken down. So people have known about it. But the thing that they have usually been interested in, these legislators, is the kind of fish that they like to eat, which is basically salmon and trout. So rich people make laws. Rich people like to fish and eat salmon and trout. And so salmon and trout get really well protected by fish passes. And you can see salmon leaping up them, but eels can't leap. They just got stuck.
Yeah, the poor neglected eels. But now there are efforts to remove some eel barriers. Some British towns have gone back to the ancient idea of eel passes. Imagine a simple device with traction to help the eels along.
Eel passes are really simple. Eels are very kind of clever creatures in some ways, and you just have to help them along. And what you give them is a channel with bits of stuff sticking out of it. They look a bit like the kind of bristles you'd get on a toilet brush. And for eels, they're just fantastic. They swarm up them. In Somerset, I went with Andy Don, who is an eel expert and has been championing eels for decades.
They're really simple devices. They are just bristle brush, really, contained within channel with a very tiny trickle of water running down them. And that small trickle of water is enough to attract eels in their thousands.
One May night, they had 10,292 pass through. And they know that because people sit there with clickers, like you have people in a bar or a nightclub. Every eel that goes up gets a click. Every eel that slides back down gets a click.
These specially constructed eel passes have helped a lot. The fish have yet to achieve a comeback to their days of old, but for English eels, the road to extinction seems to be staved off. Thanks to reporter Catherine Nixie and our friends at Economist Radio for that.
My grandfather used to play percussions, you know, my mom sings, my dad plays guitar.
That's the voice of Indy Ferreira, or just Indy. You may know her previous iteration as an artist. Until a couple of years ago, she was Dream Koala. She was born in Paris, where she lives today. Her parents are from Brazil, and as you just heard, they are also musically inclined. As an artist on the hunt for new sounds and styles, that cultural grounding helped Indy.
There are some cultural differences, you know, when your parents are immigrants and stuff. And so I feel like music is a way to kind of bond also in this way. It has been, for me at least.
So with Afro-Brazilian percussion in one ear and seemingly everything else in the other, how did Indy find what worked for her? I asked her.
I really like kind of spent most of my teenage years looking for new music on the internet, you know, like on YouTube and on Spotify and all that. And so, you know, in the album you can hear some rhythms
and so some percussions that are really like Afro-Brazilian. But you won't hear it in the same way as if you listen to a traditional album from Brazil, you know. It's like you will also maybe recognize some other elements from other genres. One of the things that was important to me is to not make an album that was kind of cliche of what people would expect from like Brazilian music, because I feel like there is a lot of, you know, cliches around, I'd say, samba, bossa nova, you know, all that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you intentionally avoided that.
Yeah, I don't know if I avoided that intentionally, but I think like I naturally was interested by something else.
Your album, the new album, Noir Brasil, has been described as an homage to your ancestors. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think not. I don't think the whole album would be defined like that, but definitely in Brazilian culture, there is a lot of homage or connection to our ancestors in like a kind of spiritual way.
Do you think you've conceived of your ancestors differently, your Afro-Brazilian roots differently than how you might have if you'd been born in Brazil?
I think yes, because, you know, my mother is a really a religious person, like my grandmother too. Like I was born in a kind of pretty religious household, mostly Catholic, but also like my grandfather was from Candomblé. So it always, like, my mother was also kind of not raised, but she always has this connection with Candomblé too. And so growing up in France, I felt like it's like, I feel like French is really less like spiritual, I feel, people than in Brazil. So it wasn't this easy growing up here and connecting to this more spiritual part of my personality. But I think that kind of some things that kind of changed is that, you know, as a black Brazilian kid in France, I feel like I've been more connected to Africa and to, you know, the Caribbean than, you know, my parents who were born in Brazil, because in Brazil you have less diaspora, you know, from Senegal or Côte d'Ivoire or Congo. You know, there is like a natural connection from that.
Indy's debut album is Noir Brasil. She's been speaking with us from Paris. Very cool music, Indy. Congratulations on the release of it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Ooh, que reste-t-il des hommes? Reste-t-il de nous? Mes souvenirs s'érodent.
We made you a playlist of Indy and other musicians we featured recently. Nearly 3 hours of cool global sounds. Hit us up on Twitter to find a link to all of that music. We are at The World. With The World. In Greece, reverence for the gyro is almost like a religion, but some restaurant owners there think it's time for a major overhaul. As this chef knows, it's going to take a hard sell.
My friend, please come down, eat one for free, and if you don't like it, you don't pay.
What's different about his gyro? That order will be up shortly here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The death of a Jesuit priest has rattled India. Father Stan Swamy was accused of terrorism and put in prison. That was based on evidence that's been discredited. The Indian government says the 84-year-old died of medical causes. Officials from the U.S. and the U.N. are now expressing concern over the situation. Indian activists are hopeful this could be a turning point for human rights in India. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
A couple of details about Father Swamy's imprisonment and death stand out. First, he got COVID while jailed for 9 months. And he had Parkinson's disease. His hands shook, so he needed a straw to drink, but his jailers wouldn't give him one. Alpa Shah is an anthropologist at the London School of Economics and Political Science who knew Father Swamy.
he was killed. It was a custodial murder. That's what's being said. And people are saying, well, you know, he's becoming a martyr for human rights. He's becoming an international martyr for human rights. You know, his death will not be in vain.
Throughout his life, Father Swami spoke out about many human rights issues, but he devoted himself to the cause of the indigenous people of India, called the Adivasi. He once explained why to Ashish Kaka, one of many Adivasi activists who considered Swami a mentor.
He said that Adivasis are the only community in India who are not materially driven. And he gave me an example to highlight that.
He says Swami told him about a time when he was sitting underneath a mango tree with a young Adivasi student and his father. The young man climbed the tree to get mangoes for them. He came down with three pieces of the fruit. Swami looked up and saw that one ripe mango had been left hanging on a branch.
He thought that the student had missed it. Maybe he couldn't see it or he couldn't climb it. So he asked him, as a matter of fact, oh, did you miss that mango? And that student, he just looked up casually and said, oh, no, that mango is for the birds.
That universal respect for nature stunned Swami. For three decades, he stood alongside the Adivasi in the eastern Indian state of Jharkhand as they fought to preserve forests and mineral-rich land. Still, the government paved the way for wave after wave of industrial development. In a recording Swami made before he was arrested and jailed, he warned that the government was cracking down. He said officials were detaining thousands of Adivasi activists fraudulently, charging many with sedition or terrorism, and holding them in overcrowded jails indefinitely without trial.
Adivasi people are speaking up. They are also paying the price for doing so. I believe we Indians are at the crossroad of choosing justice and truth versus injustice and untruth.
Swami said too many Indians were remaining silent. But there's hope that's changing now after the priest's death. Akriti Bhatia is a labor rights activist in New Delhi.
I think people who think that free speech is important and people who feel that the idea of India is getting eroded in a particular way, most of them are now questioning, are actually now thinking and coming together on this issue that we really have to fight for our political prisoners who have dedicated their lives on issues like these.
She says the situation has become more fraught in the wake of COVID as Prime Minister Narendra Modi tries to rev up the economy. He's weakened protections for natural resources, and there's been a massive expansion of coal mining. Adivasi activists like Gladson Dungdung, who've been charged with terrorism, are bracing themselves. Dungdung worked with Swami for many years.
Way forward is not very easy, but the clear thing is, you know, we are also not going to surrender. We Adivasis are determined to fight to reclaim our land, territory and resources. We are not going to leave it. So fight will go on.
The government made a mistake if it meant for its treatment of Father Swami to serve as a warning to other activists, says Swami's friend, activist Xavier Dias.
I am not afraid. I mean, what you be afraid of, death? I'm not afraid to die for a cause.
And Dias says Father Swami felt the same way about the rights of the Adivasi people.
They have hit a hornet's nest by taking stand, and it's going to backfire badly because it exposed the character of the Indian state today.
Exposed it to the Indian people and the international community. And Dias says now the question is whether they'll take action. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
New evidence confirmed again this week that the Amazon rainforest is emitting more carbon dioxide than it captures and stores. That's partly due to deforestation in the region, a problem that's increasingly well documented by satellite imaging. Now in Peru, there's a project that puts that imaging into the hands of people who can use it in real time. That's today on The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
In 2018, conservation groups in Peru gave indigenous forest monitors in dozens of communities a new phone app. It had satellite data of the forests near where they live, so they could see deforestation as it happened and stop it.
Los pueblos indígenas con pocos recursos y con herramienta tecnológica
Jorge Perez, an indigenous leader who worked on the project, says the app shows that with the right technology, indigenous people can tackle deforestation head on. Tom Buick with the Rainforest Foundation in Peru was behind the effort. So you created a system to get up-to-date satellite maps of deforestation onto smartphones, and indigenous forest monitors could use this in the field. What motivated you to try to develop a smartphone application to stop deforestation?
We developed a system of existing technology. So this great platform was emerging, Deforestation Alerts, generated by Global Forest Watch. However, we noticed that it wasn't getting out to communities who were out in the field, did not have internet access, and they were the ones that actually needed this information to take action on it. So we figured out with a couple of smartphone applications that existed that we could download the Global Forest Watch Deforestation Alerts and the map of the community into a USB and into a smartphone application, deliver the USB to the communities. Meanwhile, the communities, they patrol and verify what is the cause of the alert, document it on the app, and then deliver that back to our offices in the regional cities where there's internet, where it can be actioned upon by authorities as evidence.
Once problem data points are spotted, then what? For example, what happened when forest monitors saw a new patch of forest missing? How much could they actually do to prevent the logging or burning from continuing?
So two things they can do. One is, first of all, it's illegal. It's in their territory. So they can confront the illegal actors and say, look, we know you're here. We have eyes in the sky. If they don't respond to the, say, friendly warning or unfriendly warning, then the indigenous community will engage the authorities, which in Peru, they have an environmental police. And that happened on several occasions with coca, logging, and mining, where they brought the authorities. And then they don't have to do that every time, but you do it. We found that if you do it enough times, the illegal mafias and networks will know that the communities have the information. They will confront them. They want to protect their forests, and they will contact the authorities to take action against these actors.
So a study came out this week in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences looking at how well the project has worked to stop deforestation. What did that study find?
Well, it found that in the communities that participated, there was less deforestation, 52% actually less on average. And the surveys found that the communities were adapted the technology very quickly and incorporated the whole system of monitoring with satellite and technology into their existing governance system. So we feel like this is the beginning of what could be something scaled up and a long-term solution to a lot of the deforestation in the Amazon rainforest.
The places where this project has stopped deforestation, let me ask cynically, is the deforestation then just moving to other areas?
Within the study area, that is accounted for, and that's a very fair question. Now, the idea, however, would be that all communities, like in entire landscapes of communities, would all be participating collectively to account for, yes, that displacement or leakage.
So, Tom, what lessons has this whole experience taught you?
It's taught me that you have to work with the people on the front lines. To stop deforestation, you have to work with people where deforestation actually occurs and that have the actual authority and rights to stop it. So that's not Lima, that's not Washington, that's not London. That is in the Amazon rainforest. Second, these tools work and they are adaptable by people that perhaps don't have the education level or training that say engineers do, but they can pick up this technology, which is becoming more and more user-friendly. And then third, that direct investment has to go into indigenous communities and to authorities who actually take action, and then to measure the results of this, measure to see what works and what doesn't. Billions of dollars have gone to forest conservation, and we haven't seen very positive results, as you pointed out. This is one thing that we do know works.
Tom Buick is with the Rainforest Foundation in Peru. Thanks very much for this. Good luck with the project as you scale it up.
Thank you.
For more of our reporting on solutions to climate change, visit our website, theworld.org/bigfix. Last month in Venice, dozens of warning horns from vessels in the lagoon near St. Mark's Square. These sounds were captured on video by the group No Grandi Navi. In English, that's No Big Ships. The group launched a flotilla of small boats. They swarmed a giant cruise ship. the MSC Orchestra, and its 2,500 passengers. The lagoon in Venice had been quiet for over a year. The pandemic and cruise ships, not a great match, as we know. But since June 5th, big ships that tower over all the buildings in St. Mark's Square have been a frequent sight again. However, it's not one that will be seen after the 1st of August. This week, the Italian government named Venice's waterways a national monument and instituted a ban on large cruise ships entering the lagoon. Passengers from cruise liners will still be able to visit the canals, the winding alleyways, the art, music, and food, but only after they disembark across the water from Venice at the mainland port Marghera. Plans are now underway to construct 4 new docks there to accommodate cruise ships. For you cruisers out there already taking note, that could take a while. When you think of Greek food, what comes to mind? For me, it's the gyro. Warm pita stuffed with juicy slices of meat, pork or lamb shaved off a vertical spit. Throw in some tzatziki yogurt sauce, tomato, lettuce, and onion. OMG, it is the best. But don't take my word for it.
It's like the holy grail for the Greeks. Like, it's the number one thing. The meat, the sauces. We Greeks are kind of obsessed with this.
That's Alexandros Alexandratos. Despite his lavish praise for the gyro, his restaurant is doing something pretty controversial, making a vegan version of this traditionally meaty wrap. From Athens, the motherlode of gyros, the world's Lydia Emanolidou has our report.
It's not just the stereotype that Greeks love their meat. Lots of Greek dishes and even entire holidays revolve around lamb, pork, beef, take your pick. And if you're a fan of the 2002 movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding, you know exactly where this is going.
Ian is a vegetarian.
In this scene, the Greek protagonist tries to explain to a family member that her American boyfriend does not eat meat.
What do you mean he don't eat no meat?
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. I make lamb. Come.
Now imagine telling this Greek aunt about gyro without the gyrating meat. It's exactly what Alexandros Alexandratos has cooking at his fast casual joint in downtown Athens.
So this is I don't know how it's called in English.
The kitchen?
Okay, thank you.
Gyro is the most popular menu item coming out of this kitchen. They call it space gyro. Instead of spinning stacks of meat, they use mushrooms.
Fresh mushrooms from Greece, of course, oyster mushroom. We chop them down in little pieces.
They marinate them in a special spice blend, stick them in the oven, and then once they're browned up and tender, stuff them in the pita.
We put our traditional tzatziki that we make, tomato, onion, a little bit of mayonnaise, salad, and kaboom.
He says you've got the perfect vegan gyro. Alexandratos opened this place a couple years ago. He used to be a marine engineer before and a meat eater. He says in Greece, like in many places, meat consumption is often glorified. On American TV he watched as a kid, it was even fetishized.
Because, you know, in Greece we watch a lot of US movies, and I remember that a little kid, strong man need meat, breakfast, bacon, you know, we want the bacon. Fat, juicy steaks, medium to rare. So this thing also kind of passed to us.
Then as an adult, Alexandratos watched a lecture by this American animal rights activist, and he became convinced that giving up meat would be better for his health, for animals, and for the planet. He ate one last pork gyro and then got to thinking.
What Athens missing? Greece missing? Vegan fast food businesses, shops, that you can go, you don't eat meat, you want to eat something like healthy and fast and tasty.
So he opened Vegan Beat. On the day I visited, a couple of tourists wait outside for the restaurant to open. Sam Hickey is a New Yorker who lives in Hungary.
This is my second time here.
He was here just yesterday with his partner Lotte Nudge. She had the vegan gyro.
It was very good. I liked it so much, yeah.
Most of Vegan Beat's customers are tourists, but there are also some Greeks. Like Pater Chrysostomos, an Orthodox priest who works at a church nearby. He's not vegan, but he loves the gyro here. He says it's the most delicious thing he's ever eaten. Some Greeks and gyro purists, though, find the thought of meatless gyro hard to stomach. I pull out my phone and show Alexandratos the comments under a photo of his vegan gyro on Facebook. A lot of them are positive and people are saying, like, finally, plant-based options.
Yeah.
And then there are also people who are saying, keep your holier-than-thou attitude out of our gyro shops.
I haven't seen that. Wow. Can I read it? Stop eating my food. Classic lines.
Yeah. So there's one that says, vegan gyro accompanied by a beer without alcohol.
Okay, this is a good. I have to give him that, right? But there's also a comment that writes, that's so disgusting there. And I have replied to this comment. My friend, please come down, eat one for free. And if you don't like it, you don't pay.
Alexandrato says he gets it. I mean, we are talking about gyro after all. But he says more and more vegetarian and vegan places are popping up. Attitudes are changing. And at this point, a couple other places are serving meatless gyro too. Now, as for vegan beets, space gyro... All right, here we go. Wow, yum. Okay, I'm not saying I'm ready to give up the real thing, but really, it was out of this world. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou in Athens, Greece.
The civil war in northern Ethiopia has taken another turn. Tigrayan rebels pushed into the neighboring Amhara region on Tuesday. Now the Ethiopian government says it's ending a ceasefire and going on the offensive. It is a complex chessboard with quickly moving pieces. We turn to Michelle Gavin, a senior fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, to try and make sense of things. My colleague Carol Hill spoke with her earlier today.
Michelle, the Ethiopian government says it's ending the ceasefire with Tigrayan forces and going on the offensive. Why did they make that decision?
Well, it's clear that the Tigrayan forces intend to try and recapture territory that used to be understood as part of Tigray, and that since the fighting broke out last November has been taken over by Amhara forces, another ethnic group in Ethiopia, and claimed as part of Amhara. So though there has been a unilateral ceasefire on the part of the government, the fighting has not actually stopped. The Tigrayan defense forces have continued to try and reclaim territory. So this appears to be something of a red line for the federal government.
Orient me on this. We hear about the Amhara, Tigray, the Ethiopian forces. Kind of who are the players and where geographically do they sit here?
So you have the Tigrayan forces. Then you had the federal forces of Ethiopia. You also had Eritrean military forces crossing the border and assisting those federal Ethiopian forces. And finally, you had Amhara, essentially militia forces, local forces from the Amhara region, which does border Tigray. And there's long been tension about whose land is whose, particularly in that western part of what on a map you would see as Tigray. The Tigrayan forces, having, you know, recaptured a great deal of their territory from the Ethiopian federal forces, have pledged to sort of continue their campaign to reclaim territory and to push out all of these armed groups that were essentially aligned against them. That means the Eritreans, and it also means those Amhara forces.
So should we understand at this point that since Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has ended the ceasefire, that he's going to again send Ethiopian federal forces in to try to kind of quell this mess?
Well, it certainly looks that way. It's very clear that the Amhara are not interested in relinquishing the territory that they had gained control over without a fight. There are reports even that other forces, perhaps some Oromo armed forces who are not typically part of the federal military, might also be brought into the fight to push back on the Tigrayans. So it remains to be seen exactly what Prime Minister Abiy can muster in terms of a coalition to re-engage this fight. But what is sort of painfully clear is that the violence is by no means over.
Okay, let's look at the Tigrayan rebel forces for a second. You know, after really being diminished by Ethiopian government forces and also those who came in from Eritrea, they then regained their capital, Mekelle. I mean, to be kind of blunt, why weren't they satisfied with retaking the capital of the region and just being done with it?
Well, I think there's a tremendous amount of resentment in Tigray about atrocities that have been committed during this campaign. I certainly am not suggesting that any of the parties to the conflict are completely innocent in terms of war crimes, but it is very clear that some truly horrific crimes have been committed against the Tigrayan people, against Tigrayan civilians, sexual violence, war crimes by any definition. And so I think perhaps there is also a sentiment in Tigray that is intolerable, essentially, to allow any of the forces associated with those crimes to continue operating on what they believe to be Tigrayan soil.
What are the chances for a peaceful resolution here? In your mind, what has to happen to kind of stem this from growing into something really, really tragic?
It's clear the Eritrean forces have to get out of Ethiopia. That's just a toxic element to this equation. You know, Ethiopia just came out of federal election process that was not inclusive entirely, because obviously there was no voting in Tigray, there wasn't voting in some other restive parts of the country. It's going to be important to acknowledge that that electoral process was insufficient, right, to address this kind of underlying political tensions, arguments about the autonomy of individual regions. These are incredibly important issues that at their heart are political. So there has to be some kind of political process, rule-governed process to work through them. And that's particularly difficult right now when, you know, you still have a situation where the Tigrayans are considered terrorists by the federal Ethiopian state. It's very hard to engage in a rule-governed process with a group you've totally delegitimized. So there are a lot of roadblocks to what ultimately is the only avenue out of this mess that I can see, which really is about political dialogue.
Michelle Gavin, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Michelle Gavin, Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, speaking with my colleague Carol Hills about the conflict in northern Ethiopia. Finally today, a tale as old as time. That's how musician Marvin Brooks starts his latest track, One Breath.
A tale as old as time itself is told. So old it told itself the most.
Marvin Brooks' tale starts in Germany, born in Berlin. His father's German, his mother, Ghanaian. Brooks' dual citizenship gives him a special perspective into culture on two continents. A sense of pride, but also loss, and also joy. With this track, Marvin Brooks touches on the joy.
Rest your mind and lay your head down. Cause it's that one breath. When you're thankful, know what day you leave for yourself.
Thursday's Child has far to go. Always best to pack your bag with joy. One Breath, new music from German R&B star Marvin Brooks.
So it might flow from me to those who need to learn to hear their soul. There's so much about this life now, far too much to know. Rest your mind and lay your head down. Cause it's that one breath. When you think for no other, you leave for yourself.
And that's our show for today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, be healthy. We're back with you tomorrow.